Hey everyone, this is Carlos Morales and this is the Libertarian Atheist Podcast. Today is going to be a special reading of a fantastic article called Child Protective Services Makes Horrible Childhoods Even Worse, read by the author, who is a noted liberty activist and radio host by the name of Ellen Ball. I'm very glad that she's going to be on the show today to discuss this article. It's an insightful and courageous account of her life dealing not only with an abusive mother, but an abusive system, Child Protective Services, which made her childhood, as many people know, even more of a nightmare. Now, we're going to be taking a small break from our series on ISIS, Islam, and the Syrian refugees. I hope you guys have been kind of enjoying that show. In order to kind of go into this topic, because as many of you know, the entire reason I kind of got involved in the liberty community in the first place was because of my prior work with Child Protective Services and the doom and gloom that I legitimately saw on every single given day. Now, this story isn't exactly the clear-cut, nice story that anti-Child Protective Services advocates want, right? It's not like the parents were these amazingly great individuals and then suddenly CPS came into their lives and destroyed everything. No. Ellen's parents were, as you'll hear, pretty horrendous, and so were her grandparents. But shit is complicated, to be quite honest. And that's kind of the whole reason why it's bad to have a monopoly in the first place. Because whenever you have a monopoly, it prevents efficiency. It prevents new knowledge. It prevents originality. It disallows all of these things that are important, especially on a topic as important as the protection of fucking children. Now, she's going to be reading this article first. And of course, if you want to find out more in regards to Child Protective Services, you can find my book, Legally Kidnapped, The Case Against Child Protective Services, as legallykidnapped.net. After her reading, we will be going to a Q&A in which we kind of discuss her article and just kind of see what she's up to now. She's actually a member of the Free State Project along with me as well. So without further ado, here is Ellen.
I was 7 years old when Child Protective Services came into my life. I didn't ask for the trauma they brought into my world, neither did my family. But this is the state that we were born into, and the system that we had no choice but to abide by. Maybe if my mother had been more caring, or careful, or wise enough to follow the law, CPS wouldn't have taken over my family. I've come to realize that the fault was not only my mother's actions, but something larger than either of us. I acknowledge that there are inherent issues with any eyewitness testimony, yet my words are corroborated by more than just experiences. As a child, life was completely unstable. There was always a new man in my mother Lynn's life, which meant a new house, town, school, and people. Never having a say in where we lived, what school we went to, or who we were forced to be around did not feel right to me. There were times that I wished for it to end, but as the saying goes, be careful what you wish for. Lynn had another blowout argument with our stepfather. They had been together for several years and in that time had two children, my brother Joseph and sister Michelle. The oldest sister Noelle and I were bastards from previous flings but had always seen our stepfather as the patriarch. Hardened by years of physical labor and poverty, he still filled the role of a caring father. We never thought of the hitting and yelling as abnormal and were saddened by our mother's decision to move to Colorado. But we were clueless as to what was going on beneath the surface of what we'd been told. Lynn was a chronic drug user, philanderer, liar, and abuser that rarely worked. Getting the truth of the situation then or now would not be possible. So off we went, the four children and our childlike mother, to start a new chapter in Colorado. The first few weeks of that fall were spent in our grandparents' apartment where we began attending a new school. That is, until the day Joseph and Michelle went back to Michigan with their father who had won custody of them after Lynn so carelessly ran away, without sorting any legal issues out. She was charged with the kidnapping of her own children and sent to jail. Noelle and I were left with no legal guardian and immediately placed in state custody. We rode with an oddly friendly woman in a nicer car than I'd ever been in to the CPS building. I still remember that place. How they tried to cover up the sterility of the white office walls and fluorescent lighting by placing kids' toys everywhere. It didn't comfort me. The weak disguise only made the situation appear more catastrophic. I did not know what this place was. only that they were immensely powerful and monstrous. It was of their doing that families like mine were being ripped apart. I remember being watched through one-way glass like a caged animal as other strangers entered the room and began talking with us. I was frightened and didn't know who to trust. The only link to familiarity was my sister. As long as we were together, the world would not fall apart. Later that day, we were sent to the home of a stranger, a woman that insisted on being called Annie because it was a mash of the words auntie and granny. No matter how much she wanted, she never felt like either to us. Though she was a certified child caregiver, there wasn't one part of me that felt as if I belonged with her. The few weeks we lived in that house were nothing but torment to young minds. So stressed by the situation, I could never focus on schoolwork. In the past, school had always been an escape, and I would eagerly earn acceptable grades. But suddenly, I couldn't focus on anything and began failing every subject. At night, my sister and I would lay awake in bed, sharing memories of our missing brother and sister. I cried myself to sleep most nights. Luckily for my sister and I, the grandparents we'd been staying with claimed custody as they were the closest living relatives. They were extreme in their religion and demanding, yet it was reassurance to me that life was being normalized once more. Occasionally we would go visit our mother in jail, but the separation was stronger than the plates of glass and telephone through which we spoke. Nothing was the same, and I could no longer trust her. At least I was finally with people that were familiar once more, and the CPS nightmare was over. The next few years of my life were just as crazy as the first. Eventually, Lynn was released from her jail cell and had another child, my youngest sister, Elizabeth. She left for Michigan soon after to try and repair some of the damage she had done, leaving her three children in Colorado for a year. Upon returning, she brought with her the power of court paperwork to bring us back to Michigan. I had realized by the age of 9 that I did not like this woman called Mother, who was jerking our leashes wherever she pleased, and I had no trust or optimism about her choices. In that moment, my sisters and I would have chosen to be anywhere but with her. Lynn had missed so much of Elizabeth's young life that she clung to me for comfort and safety the entire drive back to Michigan, as if I were her mother. From there on, it was the same old thing again. A new man, new house, town, school, and people. Of course, the past never dies quietly for a woman like Lynn. The man on my birth certificate began filing to procure a court order for supervised visitation. After psychological evaluations and questioning from CPS that were ever more psychologically disturbing, we were ordered to be in a room for an hour every week with this man we didn't know at all. Noelle and I both hated it. Not only did we have to sit in awkward silence with two strangers expecting us to perform for them, we were also interrogated by Lynn after every session and coached on how to behave. She said that if we acted as if we liked him, we would have to see him more often. That was not an option that was favorable to us, but it seemed as if the CPS worker was encouraging us to interact more. I wanted to stay with my mother, and every visit was an ominous reminder that at a moment's notice, I could be forced into yet another unwanted relationship by people I did not trust. Fast forward to my 13th year on this planet. We lived in Michigan still, but Lynn had lost custody of Joseph and Michelle again to their father after moving in with my friend's family. She began dating a man she met online, and within 2 weeks found herself in a hilarious sham of a marriage. Moving in with him immediately was the next logical step for us. To no one's surprise, they were separated within 2 months. What surprised me was how she instantly had a new online boyfriend who invited her to move in with him. So one day, Lynn packed her bags and left for Florida. Noelle was 15, I was 13, and Elizabeth was only 4. We were left with nothing but the promise of money in the mail and the house we were staying in. Despite how insane this sounds, I was determined to take care of my remaining family. Noelle was the first to crack under the pressure. 3 days of being alone was enough to spill the whole story to her school counselor. This is where Child Protective Services entered our lives yet again. The three of us moved in with grandparents a few towns over immediately following the home invasion of state workers. Technically, this was not allowed as they were not licensed care providers by the state. But in this emergency situation, we were allowed to stay because they were the closest living relatives. To have the story end there would have been a relief. But nothing is ever as easy when it comes to government agencies. Noel and I were appointed an attorney by the court to properly define what we thought was our best interest at the court hearings that took place every other month. There was no getting around it. If we didn't show up, then it would be decided for us what our interests were. Representatives from CPS, from different departments, and at times estranged family members would show up in the courtroom to argue what they thought we should do. It felt incredibly demeaning to me, being talked about so impersonally as a piece of property. We stayed with our grandparents, however, and for the first few months struggled to find our place in a household not prepared for children. CPS workers would come to visit us every month. We would talk with our grandparents in the room, as well as in an isolated area where there is no guilt for being honest. Our relationship was strained from the beginning of the move by their belief that everyone, including us, had bad intentions. Though they cared for us, it was blatantly obvious that we were unwanted. They were made to go through parenting classes and update the house so that everything was up to code. After that, they were deemed fit to raise children and given a nice plaque to hang on the wall. Living with my grandparents was viewing them in full for the first time in all of their miserable glory. They both worked for the state in the mental health industry, which is enough to drive anyone crazy. What's more, they used their position to gain access to prescription meds, get out of tickets, and look like heroes. Every single night, they would sit at the kitchen table and slowly fill the entire garbage bucket with beer cans and boxes of wine. Despite signs like the daily hangovers, no one else was aware of how deeply alcoholic they were. At each monthly visit, we were repeatedly questioned about how safe we felt and where we wanted to stay. Noel and I were frightened by our grandparents' alcoholism, yet were more frightened by the prospect of facing them with their issues. It was entirely possible that they would grow violent with us. Some nights the alcohol would burn their veins enough to scream the most brutal words at us. If this went on long enough, my grandfather could get physical. Though we never said anything about this aloud, our behaviors were comparable to most children suffering from abuse. We were withdrawn, irritable, and unsociable. I felt let down by Child Protective Service workers. Their job, they told me, was to make sure that we were in the best home for our care. The only thing they cared about, it seemed, were the fire alarms and escape windows. How much money went through their hands in placing us? At every turn, they were convincing us that we were in a safe, loving home with all we could ever ask for. They could not have been more disconnected from our situation. The biggest failure on their part came one day when I least expected it. I'd spent the night at my friend's house and been running cross-country all morning when the news came that my grandparents would not be showing up because Elizabeth had hurt her leg. My initial response was to think that it was a minor scratch she was getting too much attention over. When I arrived back at home, I opened up the trash can to throw away the sweatband I'd worn that morning. Of course, it was full of beer cans. Noel was the only one home, and when I asked her what happened, I was shocked by the dark truth. The night before, Elizabeth had fallen asleep on the couch. My grandfather stumbled down the hall as he carried her to bed, accidentally crushing her leg against the bathroom door frame. Despite her cries, he passed out cold. In the night, she dragged herself out of bed and into the living room where they found her in the morning. Luckily for them, the alcohol was out of their system, so they made the choice to take her to the hospital. My grandfather was outwardly broken up over the incident. He cried about how he was at fault for breaking Elizabeth's leg, but swore up and down that he had not been drinking the night before. I felt that I knew the truth about what happened, but my evidence was merely circumstantial. When the CPS workers pulled me out of class to ask questions about the occurrence, I told them everything I knew. It must not have been enough, though. Nothing changed. The years passed, and the disdain for my grandparents grew. Every passing court hearing was a reminder that I belonged to those in control of my fate. They used a more pleasant term for it, ward of the court. I had nowhere to go, even though I didn't want to stay. If I had run away, the police would have come after me. My friend's parents were sympathetic and at times would suggest that I should stay with them. I never took it seriously until after an event which changed the course of my life. One night, my boyfriend and I were in the basement watching a movie when my grandmother yelled down the hall, "It's time for bed, Ellen! Come upstairs!" I was not aware that I had a bedtime, so slowly I said goodnight and began putting the movie in its case. It was not fast enough, because my grandfather charged down the stairs yelling. I was shoved up the stairs as he accosted my boyfriend with all the things he was suspected of. As we all entered the kitchen, my grandparents competed to yell over each other about how disrespectful we were. "Have you been sleeping with her? Because I'll charge you with rape. We would both feel much better if you weren't our responsibility anymore." Trying to catch my breath between tears, I agreed to call the CPS worker in charge of my case in the morning. Maybe I could finally create a positive change for my family. Noelle had run away a month earlier, burnt from the lack of care from CPS and abuse from our grandparents. For Elizabeth, it seemed too late. She had already been adopted by them. If my account of the incident could change the agency's mind about the competency of my grandparents to raise children, then I would feel more secure in the safety of my youngest sister. Despite my grandfather's sad attempt at an apology, I called my caseworker in the morning and told her that I was moving. I gave every detail I could recall from the night before, then went to visit Anne, my friend's mother. She was very gracious and understanding, saying, "Whatever we have to do, kiddo, it'll get taken care of." It was her willingness to go through the licensing process and be there with me to face my grandparents that saved me. Before she was licensed, though, I was not allowed to stay with her, the CPS agents told me. Regardless of the incident and all that they knew of my grandparents, they were deemed a better legal home because of their license. So I was forced to be there at least 5 days a week. The next 3 months could not have been more awkward. My grandparents now knew that I was not totally helpless, that I was capable of making decisions and taking a stance. My grandfather would bitterly tell me how shameful it was to be separated from the family. Sarcastically, he hoped that I would have a pristine life. I knew this didn't look good for public servants, but they deserved all the credit for my decision to leave. Anne had to go through the same process as my grandparents had in order to house me. Home improvements had to be made, and monthly visits were a must. The judge in charge of my case was dumbfounded and fought my opinion every step of the way. He said, "Usually I don't take advice or opinion from the child on placement. The closest family member is always the best option. But here you are, a bright young girl who does well in school, completely disagreeing with me. I can only assume that you have a good reason for this, so I'll respect your wishes and place you with your friend, but only after she's been licensed." Each court hearing, the same questions were asked, as if he could not trust that I had made a wise decision. "Are you sure you want to stay with this friend? Your grandparents love you. They're your family, and they're at every hearing." I was not given the chance to explain to him that I did not choose my family. It was slightly over a year that I lived with Anne, and though our relationship eventually grew strained, I knew that I had made a far better choice for myself than the court system and Child Protective Services would have. The final year living under the control of CPS was the best by far, though still restrictive. Each visit, my CPS worker would ask me about college and push me to fill out forms for financial aid. I knew I would not be going to college that fall. I had secret plans to move to New Hampshire and start fresh without the weight of all these bad experiences following. Instead, I played along, filling out forms and applying to colleges. It was what I felt I had to do to have the case closed by the time I turned 18. In the last few months before my 18th birthday, I was hardly ever home. I did not wish to live there, yet legally, I had to. The money that Anne was getting each month from the state for housing me had become an issue when it was brought up that it should have been going towards my expenses. I wanted nothing to do with that stolen money, though, or the organization that distributed it. I just wanted to be out. On my birthday, the case was closed once and for all. I was finally deemed old enough to decide for myself overnight. There will never be a way to repair the damage or get back those stolen years that the Child Protective Services took from me. Not being listened to, trusted, or even respected on a human level set my psychological development back by years. I was bitter, desperate, and extremely frustrated with everyone around me. The only emotions I was accustomed to were fear and anger. Happiness didn't come for a while. It's no wonder I chose to be in an abusive relationship for almost 4 years. I was raised in a way that created the illusion of a lack of choice. Moving to New Hampshire was the first major choice I made with my freedom from the law. Every choice since then has been a cascade of more opportunity for me to appreciate the feeling of being a sovereign individual. After these refreshing few years being surrounded only by the loving and supportive people that I've chosen to be friends and family, I can finally tell this story without shame, guilt, or tears. Flashbacks and emotional fragility are still problems that I struggle with. But with the encouragement from the community, I've recovered enough to be honest, happy, and have respect for myself. I found interests and learned to love waking up in the morning. Currently, I'm attending college and have anticipation for the future. The real solution to the problem of careless or unwilling parents, it seems to me now, is the loving support of good people. Having consideration for the emotional needs of children is the first step. An understanding of children's capabilities to know what is in their best interest is essential for their well-being and development. Currently, we are raising a generation of children that don't know what it's like to walk the street alone, play outside all day, or have critical thinking skills. These children will be less capable of knowing what they want, or how to succeed if they are never entrusted with their own choices. We need to have the bravery to speak up and empower these individuals to succeed. I hope the story will be helpful in revealing what life is like for children who suffer a similar fate in the hands of a government agency that is completely disconnected from situations, and how utterly they fail in helping children. My mother was a brutal parent, and there are many other brutal parents in America. But the agency set on preventing abuse has failed at doing their job. There is no justification for child abuse, even if it's done by she who gave the child the chance to take their first breath, which is why a monopoly can't fix it. There are thousands of solutions to fixing the problem of abuse in this world, but when the hammer of the state gets involved, everything becomes a nail. The history and present activities of CPS has been a testament to the failure of government on every level. Only when we move past the status paradigm can we prevent the catastrophic failures in my childhood and begin to heal those who have been hurt.
So, first off, thank you very much, Ellen, for being on the show as well as, you know, writing this article. How have you ever really been open with other people in regards to what you experienced with Child Protective Services, especially in such a public way as it was whenever you posted on thinkaboutnow.com?
No, I honestly have not talked about it in as much depth as I have here in this article. I've mentioned it, of course, to a few people that are close with me, but it's not usually a subject that I like to discuss or, you know, just bring up in conversation. It's usually very hard for me to even get onto the topic. So to write this article was like getting all of this off of my chest, and it was very relieving and uplifting.
Yeah, I've known you for probably 2 or 3 years at this point, and we've kind of dabbled and talked about these issues before, though I didn't know kind of the extensiveness of this. I asked you kind of to possibly write up some article in regards to your past. I guess this was a couple months ago, and I remember reading the first draft. I was actually on an airplane back from San Diego to New Hampshire. And I don't know, after vacations, you're always in this kind of ultra dramatic mode in your head, at least for me.
Because you're going back home.
Yeah.
It's like you're going back to something familiar. You're saying goodbye to all those fun memories.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a sad moment.
And so I'm on this fucking airplane, though, with like complete sleep deprivation, and I'm basically crying in the middle row of an airplane reading about your story because it ripped me apart, though. Honestly, it was one of those, it hits you on such a visceral level because for me, I get these emails all the time regarding Child Protective Services, and I apologize to people who I can't respond to everything because, you know, you get an influx of 50 to 60 a day, and I don't exactly have a secretary, and it's not exactly a paying gig. But a lot of these stories I read about, they're generally from parents. And many of the parents, I'm sure, are being honest with me regarding what's occurring. But I do kind of think sometimes, are these parents who are messaging me necessarily good parents themselves? And it's hard to battle that. Like, how many people are legitimately violent, horrific fucking parents are using some of the information?
Yeah, it's hard to know who to trust.
And so when I'm reading your article, it puts me in a difficult position. Because it puts anyone in a difficult position who's against Child Protective Services, because it's not as if this was a clean cut. Your parents are these great people who happen to smoke some weed, and then CPS shows up out of nowhere and destroys your lives.
Right. It was already kind of destroyed when they came in. They just made it worse.
Yeah.
I know it might be more believable coming from me because I actually went through it. I'm not just some crazy adult who's upset because I'm losing my children.
Yeah.
This actually happened, and I guess it's different when you hear it coming from somebody in that sort of narrative way.
And someone who I know, like I've known you for a while, you know what I mean? And it makes me feel mad, right? It makes me want to go back in time and shake everyone and say, "Fucking stop it!" Which is generally, I think, what most libertarians, I think, all we're trying to do really is grab people, shake them, and say, fucking stop it.
Yeah, well, and you can even tell, like, from your story about how you knew me before you even knew about this story, that must make it much more effective. Because, I mean, most people who you get to know beforehand, you grow to like them, you get to know them a little bit more, then out of the blue, there's this shocking story about their terrible past, and that must make it much more difficult to deal with.
Yeah, I mean, a person who's kind of co-hosting the show for a while, MK Lords or Megan Callison, you know, she went into one of her speeches being a victim of domestic violence and abuse as a child, and other people have been on the show and, you know, expressing these ideas and things that occur to them in the past that really make my past look pretty easy, outside of the CPS part, obviously. And it's amazing to me the resiliency of people. So some people who were in your position, who had to deal with the shit that you had to deal with, they are drug addicts, they are sex workers, they are people in really bad positions who haven't been able to do a lot of positive things in their life. And you are kind of inspirational on that end, where you managed to move out of that situation. You are living, you know, working with the Free State Project. You have a job that you don't hate. You, as far as I know, you're not addicted to anything. So doing pretty well. So
thank you
on that end. But, what do you think it is that makes certain people more resilient than others?
I honestly, there's no way that I have a very scientific mind, so it's hard for me to analyze it down to that sort of level, but there are certain people who just never seem to grow out of it. It sticks with them, and it is a traumatic thing when you go through things as a child. It sticks with you for a long time, and it comes back to haunt you, even though you may think that you've grown out of it. If you maintain the same status quo as far as like analyzing yourself and your life and kind of putting those problems on the back burner and never coming to face them, then they're always going to stick with you. But I think the people that grow above these sort of experiences are people that acknowledge that it happened and say to themselves, I don't have to be like this. I can be a better person. I can break the cycle. Because if you don't, then it's just going to continue from generation to generation, which is what I happened to notice with my family, was that my grandparents were very terrible parents to my mother, and my mother ended up being terrible in a different sort of way, but she was terrible nonetheless. I grew up my entire childhood knowing this is not what I want to be like. I want to be something different. I want to be better. I kept reading books to get away from my life, just to escape into a world where people made sense. And it was That was probably the most influential thing to me, was being able to choose the role models that I wanted to emanate. And I guess that's eventually what happened, was that I started picking up these virtuous things that I kind of learned about from people that didn't even exist in my life, because everybody else around me was, they were just crazy. And I knew that, I saw that. So I don't know if it's something you're born with or something that you learn, but I knew from even a young age that there was something wrong and I wanted to change that.
You know, it's funny though, you kind of bring up fiction and the ideas in regards to that, which most fiction, especially involving young people, is generally that exactly. You know, Harry Potter is the story of a kid whose parents died and he's living in an abusive house, so he makes things up in his head that he's a wizard.
And I loved Harry Potter.
Yeah.
I was crazy about it when I was younger.
Yeah, and you have similar things with Luke Skywalker. You know, he's living in this terrible situation, and then he makes up this idea that he has force powers and everything else, and suddenly he's out of this position.
Right.
If you think of these stories as basically the stories of crazy children, it makes it way more interesting, at least to me. But it is that fanciful way to be able to dislodge and leave the place that you're in. Of course, you know, kids now generally would do that with something like video games, although we're in the age range to do that. Although now, games are certainly more enticing and gripping than they were in the past.
But yeah, the only games I played when I was growing up were shooting games or racing games, things that like raised your adrenaline and got out the anger.
Yeah, but they weren't like dramatic stories. No. Although I guess people had that shit with Zelda. I was never really a Zelda fan. Anyway, the side tangent. But what would you say though to people who kind of would use your story as proof that child abuse isn't that bad? And I know that sounds weird, but there are people who you will bring up your childhood and then they'll see the person you are right now and then go, well, if you could get through it, then it couldn't have been that bad.
You know, that's more believable than you might think, because I see posts like that on Facebook from people that I'm kind of related to or I know from my past that I'm not super close with anymore. They'll post things like, my parents beat me, and I turned out fine. I learned to respect them from that. And to me, that just says that they are still carrying that with them. They still think it's okay to beat their children. And it's really not, because if you... I think that they've disconnected themselves from the situation of being a child in that situation where you have no control over what happens. You're just at the mercy of these adults that are like three times your size, and what they say goes, and if you go against that, then you're going to get beaten. It's really hurtful, not only physically, but also mentally, because it makes you feel like you have no control. It makes you feel like anything you do could be wrong, and it kind of brings down your self-esteem to this level where you can't make decisions without feeling bad or without fearing. So I would say to anybody who thinks that that's all right, that they are so disconnected, they don't see what they're doing, and it's being hurtful not just then, but also in the future. And just because I turned out right doesn't mean that other children will. I think you can clearly see just based on how the majority of people who have been abused when they were children lead their lives, that's evidence enough.
Yeah, there's a few points that I like bringing up whenever people bring that up or they make that statement that I turned out all right. I was drinking and driving last night. I didn't get into an accident. Therefore, there's nothing wrong with drinking and driving because I ended up all right.
Right.
When I was a kid, I used to drive around without a seatbelt on at all times, jumping around from seat to seat. I never died. Therefore, it was all right. Similarly, and I think, and this has to be thought about whenever that statement is made, if you believe as an adult that it is justifiable to smack someone the third your size who has evolved to love you and to be obsessed with you and it has a need to be nurtured by you, if you think it's right in your head to smack that person in the face because you're angry, then you're not all right.
Yeah, I always want to ask people that. Are you really all right?
Are you
because
sure?
You see these people, always miserable. There's something that they're not happy about that they're just ignoring.
Yeah.
They say, oh, I'm all right. And then they're, you know, working in a dead-end job for years on end. Or they just go home and they get drunk every night. Or they just sit and watch TV. They don't do anything with their lives. They're really not all right. They can't develop healthy relationships with people. They're always caught up in petty issues. They're highly emotional in regards to some things. It's pretty clear to me that if you say, no, I was beaten and I'm all right, you're not all right. That's insane. You can't say that. I don't. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
And certainly, and another point that has to be thought of is there are people, though, who then reject their parents later on in life and state, you know, this isn't for me. I didn't deserve to be treated like that. But then they don't really do the therapy they need for themselves or interactions for therapy later on, which then leads them to just be resentful people and be completely certain that whenever they have kids, they won't make those same mistakes without trying to deal with the trauma that is still built up inside of them. And that, I've seen that repeatedly in people like in the unschooling movement and the like, where they were beaten as a kid, so now they think that possibly they're not allowed to tell children anything, as in unparenting, essentially, or that their predilections towards alcoholism and drug use isn't that bad as long as you're not hitting your child. And so it's about rethinking all these different values that we have and all these different actions that we're committing in a more rational lens, a more rational context. And that can be very difficult and overwhelming.
It's one of the most difficult things in the world to overcome a trauma that's followed you since childhood. It takes so much time with self-analysis and figuring out, what triggers you and how you can deal with that in a healthy way. Because to have a child, you have to take on the responsibility of knowing that they are going to depend on you, both physically and emotionally. So you have to be there not only to support them and encourage them, but also to know that when they do something that irritates you, you're not going to fly off the handle, which very well could happen unexpectedly. And that's what happens when you don't deal with those problems. But it's a necessary part of becoming a parent.
I would like to thank you, Ellen, for being on the show and having this discussion and being really open and honest with your article, which again can be found at thinkaboutnow.com, which honestly has become my page, along with Ellen, seeing as how she's written, I think, the last like three articles that I've actually posted on there. So I'm really glad that she's been helping me update that particular website. And of course, if you guys are interested, you can find everything at legallykidnapped.net if you want to learn more about child protective services.
I could go off the deep end. I could kill all my best friends. I could follow